Welcome, podcast listening trainees, to the Three Men and a Retrospective's look at the entire Mission Impossible film franchise. Join IMF agents Garrett, Matt, and Adam as they review each film in the Tom Cruise starring saga about daredevil agent Ethan Hunt and his team of world-saving emissaries. Pay attention, trainees, as knowledge of all that is discussed will determine whether you are worthy of joining the Impossible Mission Force. So strap yourselves in, IMF trainees. The Percolated Media Mission Impossible Retrospective begins now.
Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1, released July 12, 2023. Budget was $291 million, although it's rumored to be up to three. Box office was $571.1 million, and this is once again directed by Christopher McQuarrie. All right, boys, this was the movie that we were actually going to end this retrospective on way back when we started the site. It fell through. And we just decided, you know what, we're going to wait for the final reckoning, which we're going to get next week. But Matt, I got to ask you, we were going to end on this, and the press for this wasn't exactly high, was it?
Well, I wouldn't say that it was not anticipated, because it definitely was. But this is one of the larger gaps in time. Now, there were world circumstances that prevented this thing's production and not releasing 5 years after Fallout. But there was a lot of discussion about... The budget was probably the biggest thing that just kept being discussed. And the fact that when they said part one, there was a huge part of me that clenched up. Because that's a trend I'm kind of sick of. With very few exceptions, I don't feel like whenever I get, oh, this is the first film in a two-part finale, very seldom do I walk out of that first one feeling satisfied. Like I got a full resolution. And I was worried that this was going to follow suit.
Adam, you weren't originally going to be on that retrospective, so at this point, were you actually looking forward to Dead Reckoning Part 1 when it was being released?
Yeah, I was one of those, I was the Jeremy Renner. I got brought in midway through. they changed me out, but unlike Renner, I get kept around till the end. I was looking forward to it, mainly because of Fallout. For some reason, the last couple movies did really reinvigorated me, and yeah, I was excited to see it. Tom Cruise had kind of brought cinema back with Maverick. You know, what he and Kaczynski did was pretty damn phenomenal. And so I was really excited. The trailers didn't do much for me. I was very aware of the press's reactions to it, but I didn't care. I wanted Mission Impossible in theaters.
Like a lot of movies we've been discussing lately, this was hit by the COVID-19 bug. It took about 4 years to film this thing. After McQuarrie had a script and he was already announced as director, that's when the virus hit. And there is footage out there of Cruise yelling at his crew members for not wearing a mask and not keeping 2 feet apart. Matt, as you mentioned before we hit record on this thing, I mean, that kind of put Bale to shame, didn't it?
It certainly did, although this came from more of a greater good perspective than you're ruining my shot. So at least there was a certain amount of justification, as exaggerated as I thought it was. I think Cruise, much like Ethan Hunt, as the series has progressed, has developed a messiah complex about saving multiplexes.
Yep.
And I can't say it's unwarranted, because nobody expected Top Gun Maverick to be as well-received and well-regarded as it was, nor the fact that it would make almost $1.5 billion 2 years removed from COVID. Yeah, that was 2022. At a time where a lot of movies that were getting released in theaters were either getting limited releases or underperformed because they were trying to overcompensate with streaming services, 2 week release window, all that stuff. So I think he had a certain amount of, much like Maverick himself, he had a certain amount of self-confidence that he kind of earned. And I was far more excited for this than I was for a Top Gun sequel, because this had the precedent of two films that I greatly enjoyed that I think are far and away the two best films in this franchise. So I really had no reason outside of the delays and the ballooning budget to be anything but excited.
Yeah, you mentioned him being the messiah, the one who saved cinema. That was a big thing. And the three of us, we started the site when Maverick was out. It was one of our first full retrospectives, was that two-film retrospective we did. And we were all three of us were pretty high on it, and you're right, that thing grossed over $1 billion. Hell, even my fiance loved it. It really grew him back into the public's good graces. And so with that and that alone, I was actually pretty excited for this, and I was the same as you guys. The trailers did nothing for me. But here's the other thing too, and this is probably a big reason why we didn't go through with that retrospective, Matt. A, we had trouble communicating with the person who, the third, who was going to be on it. And B, my heart was broken 2 weeks before by Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that was something that, of all the new releases that we've done, not just here, but at the old place, I think that was probably one of the most heartbreaking disappointments, because I wanted to love it so much. And this came out, what, a month and a half after that?
A couple weeks, actually.
It was also the third part one that summer. There was this, there was Fast X, and there was Across the Spider-Verse. All of them were part ones of a two-part finale. So that combination of factors didn't make me nervous, because I felt like with McQuarrie at the helm and all the, like I said, the track record at this point, really from three on to varying degrees, I felt more confident about this than I did Dial of Destiny, because this did not have five writers on it.
That's true.
But you're right. And also, this is crazy coincidence, the plots of them are actually pretty similar.
Adam, Dial of Destiny broke all three of our hearts. Did that factor into your anticipation for this?
You know, I clearly, and for those that want to remember, go back and listen to it. I think I'm the only one that'll tell you to do that. But I was the highest on Dial of Destiny out of all of us. But it was the part one of it all. You know, I'm not a big fan of that. It's the Fast X of it all. And that, oh, Jesus criminy. Go back and listen to that one. It's amazing that we got the part two of this one quicker than we got the part two to Across the Spider-Verse, and supposedly those were done at the same time. Freaking Miller and Lord lying their asses off. Fucking 5 to 6 year wait between those movies. But it was just, I don't know, either make it a finale or don't. And then when you look at the runtime, and that still wasn't going to do it. But I felt that Paramount was padding out what they had assumed would be $2 billion grosses because of Maverick. I feel like this was expanded because of what that movie did. And I was okay with, you know, look, you can stretch it out and not bore me to tears, but I don't think it takes very long before you realize that this movie's been pretty manipulated.
Well, also, that logic tracks, because they removed the part one subhead by the time that this went to both home media, as limited as that's become, and streaming. Like, if you go on Paramount Plus, it's just called Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning, which I think is a better title. I don't like adding a part one, because it makes it a real outlier in the series, especially with what the next one is called. It would have really stuck out inconsistent. So I'm glad they wised up and got rid of it.
It is not wise to put a part one after a title that has dead in it. It just didn't make any sense to me.
Did they learn nothing from Divergent?
Yeah, no shit.
Hunger Games.
So going back to the release of this, it comes out, and it grosses about $83 million its first weekend. But then Cruise was pissed because they only had a week window of IMAX showings before another movie the three of us did, Oppenheimer, came out.
And Barbie.
And Barbie, yeah. Yeah, that's right. That was in the middle of Barbenheimer. It took a 64% drop the next week. And look, it made $571 million. So that's no small feat, but that's worldwide. I would say this kind of disappointed. So the fact they made this part one, Matt, you hit Divergent. I mean, I was worried they weren't even going to finish this thing.
I didn't think it would be that drastic, because they had, I'm sure Tom Cruise would have forked over some money to get this made, because these have become real labors of love for him, in a way that very few franchises are for a particular star. Although it's kind of I look at him as the good version of what has happened compared to Vin Diesel getting more involved with Fast and Furious. But I will say this made $200 million more than Dial of Destiny did. So it showed that, and the budgets were almost identical when you look at them. So there is a lot of similarities between the two. But I knew that there was going to be a part two come hell or high water. I just thought, when you get this far along and you have a star the magnitude of Tom Cruise, it was going to get made one way or another.
I mean, it was going to happen. One, I hate that he's poking fingers at it. Look, Tommy, I don't see a movie in IMAX unless I have to, because I'm not impressed with it. And there's I mean, what did it make total in IMAX? Like 50 million of its grosses? Mm. It isn't massive. There's more faux IMAX. There's more ScreenX, Dolby. Like, there's so many other formats. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe he's got a stake in IMAX as a corporation. But, God, I that's just bitching and I mean, blame. I mean, shit. Too bad. Tough titty. If this thing would have had legs, IMAX would not be in the discussion. So, to me, that's just blaming something that's not worth blaming. It was being made. To Matt's point, yeah, I think he would have coughed up money if he had to. I think he would have got, I don't know, maybe tax-free investment from a certain quote-unquote religion if he had to make the movie. But yeah, part two was being made only because his ego would not let it not be made at this point.
And also, what I wanted from this was, I wanted something similar to No Time to Die, which I still really like. I liked it at the time. I felt like for American audiences and for Tom Cruise, for a 30-year franchise, I think he earned the right to kind of have a proper send-off, which is what this looked like by all intents and purposes. And no, I didn't get that with Dial of Destiny 2, which also didn't help, because there's so few. And I also think, let's talk about this. I don't think this was intended to be the climactic installment until it was in development. I have thoughts on that.
Now, Matt and I saw this because we thought we were going to review it. So we
well, we would have seen it regardless.
You're right. And just like next week's film, my fiance put her hand up and was like, yep, you go. She wants nothing to do with these movies. Adam, did you see this opening weekend?
Nope. Somebody sent me a early online version of this that I could see. Because of seeing that, I ended up not going back to see it in a movie theater.
All right. I was not expecting that. Okay. So, unless anybody has anything else to add, we're going to get into this because, my God, we have about 2.5 hours of plot to dive into.
Plus, it's 2:40. It's 2:45. And when I saw that runtime, my eyes rolled into the back of my skull like The Undertaker.
Oh, wait till next
for
week.
For a part one.
Yeah.
For a part one. Yeah,
for a part one, which... I mean, the other thing is, how many franchises have done the shooting two movies back to back, and it's actually worked for both cases? Harry Potter was the best because they had a book to go off of.
Adam, I don't know about you, but now I want to see Matt with the Undertaker eyes rolled back in the back of his head. So, Adam, you're not going to be a part of this conversation. I'll talk to Matt about this. I remember seeing this in theaters. I was there opening weekend, and before it even started, I was greeted by Tom Cruise and Chris McQuarrie welcoming me to the theater and thanking me for going to the theater to see this. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I half expected to get a my own IMF glasses as I walked out of the theater.
We open up with the Paramount and Skydance logos as we cut to under the Bering Sea to a submarine full of Russians. We see a key of some sort being inserted as the Arctic ice cap is navigated, and they turn on the stealth. But the AI has other plans as it rebels and attacks, taking the submarine completely out. All right, I want to say something that might be a hot take right off the bat.
Oh, here we go.
I want to get this out of the way. I love the idea that the villain of this movie is AI. Yes, we will have a personification of a villain later, and we'll get to him when we get to him. But the idea that while the U.S. sabotaged this mission to make sure the stealth isn't used, yet the AI took matters into its own hands and sunk it is terrifying to me. This is something that James Bond has never tackled. And I think the concept, I repeat, the concept of this villain is pretty damn great. We'll get to the execution, but I love the concept.
I agree to a certain extent. I think conceptually this is really cool because it's the most techno thriller type of device that this series has ever had. And it also represents this movie, these two movies that we'll talk about between this and next week. It's the most political on the world stage that this movie franchise has done without going too far into just outright displaying political perspectives. I think that's fine. But I think this trope of just sentient AI is something that I'm just tired of seeing in general. I mean, this goes all the way back to, I mean, this thing was produced by Skydance. I think that's a lie. I think it was Skynet that produced this. But I think it's fine. But I always think some of these action franchises, when they resort to AI or getting more cyber tech-y, often lose a lot of their luster. Because Fast and Furious made that mistake eventually. One of the Die Hard movies did that. I can't remember which one. But it was the one where Timothy Oliphant was the villain.
Yep, that's number four.
That one, I mean, look, that movie's almost 20 years old now, so that thing feels dated just by default. But I will say it was a smart thing because AI had really evolved in just 5 years since Fallout. It was topical. It was in the news. So I think it was smart to do it as it was intended. But we'll talk about the execution.
Ideas don't always work out. And yes, as a idea and as a concept, hey, not a bad one. And we'll discuss it later, but maybe your concept to have AI be the villain is a better one than having what seems to be AI write your fucking screenplay. So I'll put that out there right now up front.
Yeah, and to your point, there's a reason why James Bond never did AI. Maybe they learned. I mean, not that they got ridiculous. I mean, that's the same franchise where they went into outer space, for God's sake, as a movie. So I just have problems with this opening. I think that the acting in this is really stilted. It doesn't feel natural. And to Adam's point, the dialogue in this feels like it was written by AI. I feel like I'm watching a knockoff of The Hunt for Red October for this whole opening.
Well, the whole, with the exception of the second one, which did have a personification of Ethan, this is the first time we've had an opening without Ethan Hunt. And I'm thinking when they're seeing something approach, I'm like, oh, there's Ethan. He's going to board this thing. No, he doesn't. So just the absence of him makes this seem different. It almost seems like a, Matt, remember the X-Files openings? They were like this, where we have something that intrigues us and we want to know what exactly happened. So the absence of Ethan Hunt threw me off.
Well, it's also very similar. A lot of the Bond films open like this.
Yeah.
Where you have a cold open where he's not involved, but you find out it actually ties into the overall story. Like, I think of, like, Live and Let Die is a good example, which I think was the mantra for the screenwriting in this movie.
Well, it should be said that McCoy didn't write this by himself. He had this guy from Band of Brothers. We're going to talk about the screenplay as we go. I also want to mention, too, that this was interesting when I did research on this film. So this sound effect that happens every time the AI approaches, that the entity, as we'll come to know it, approaches. This helicopter sound. McCrory had a screening for this for his friends, you know, like Lucas used to do. And one of the guys who was there was Edgar Wright. And he watched this and was like, you know what? It's cool. But every time that entity approaches, you need a sound. You need something to personify it. So as a result of that conversation, that's why we get this kind of helicopter sound that happens every time it's here. I kind of like that. That was a good suggestion, I think.
I like the blip, almost like a blip sound that they came up with. I also like the production design inside the vault that the entity is kept in. It looks like the big golf ball from Epcot that houses Spaceship Earth.
Thanks, Venetians.
Adam, what do you think of this sound?
It's fine. But yeah, I get it. Anytime your villain is quote-unquote antagonist, maybe is the better word, but anytime it shows up, yeah, you have the sound. Cool, yeah. I guess what? Yes, I understand how the Dark Knight works as well to set mood. I get it. But there it was done well. Okay. I have a problem with the entity. God, even that fucking name gives me douche chills. I have a problem with the entity.
I do wish they came up with a better name. I don't know what you could have called it.
I was going to say, what do you call it?
I don't know, placeholder? Because that's obviously what the name was in the script, and they never changed it. Somebody wrote entity, and they forgot to fucking copy Control-C to change the name out.
I was going to say, too bad Virtuosity was already taken.
Oh, my God. Mm. Oh, don't get Adam started on that one. That's like Oblivion, where Adam's just going to go on and on and on.
No, yeah, but they should have called it, like, Project Blank or something like that. Give it some kind, because they come up with, not that rabbit, like Rabbit's Foot is more clever than this.
Wow. See, I had no issues with this.
Or Chimera. They've had some interesting like code names for the big devices. Just calling it the entity, that's like Hitman, where the group he works for is just called the organization. Like, how fucking lazy can you be?
I was not expecting a Hitman reference in this podcast.
What's next? The shop? I mean, come on.
Oh, low blow. So we see bodies floating up to the surface, and the guy with the key is what we end the scene on. We then cut to an Uber Eats delivery as Ethan gets the correct security question and receives his mission and says, welcome to the IMF.
Ethan Hunt must have a kink for decrepit apartment buildings.
I was thinking the same thing.
Like, is this how he spends his off time?
Just in these blank spaces? I think so.
Your Uber Eats driver screwing up your designator code.
Adam, come we're on, not man. 10 minutes in, man, and you are already just in a rage. What is this?
I'm walking out to refill my popcorn that's still half full just to stretch my legs.
We hear that 30 years ago, Ethan joined the IMF and that they will never forget the death that brought him to the IMF all those years ago. All right.
This is Paramount thanking Tom Cruise.
Let's talk about this. This guy... This Gabriel, this person we have never heard of until this point, is someone whose murder of someone close to Ethan has haunted this character we have followed for almost 30 years, and we are just now hearing about?
All right, so I have a lot to say about this. This is the problem with doing, one of the many problems when you do a definitive ending where you're trying to tie everything together. Because it makes you ask the question, if this guy was so important to Ethan Hunt and his background, why has he never been mentioned before? And B, this death, like we know that all of them were offered the choice. Like they all had criminal records, were going to be imprisoned if they didn't join the IMF. Why was this never talked about? If you're going to bring this up now, it's only here to make a thematic through line for the cyclical nature of trying to tie this whole series together. I think it's a big mistake, especially because at the end of this movie, we don't know who this woman is. No. We'll never, at the end of this movie, we don't know. It's never answered.
Nope.
So my assumption was, okay, they'll explain it in part two. And this also reeks of a rewrite because this villain was originally going to be played by Nicholas Holt.
Yep. I was going to mention that. Yep.
If you remember, he was cast and there's no fucking way it could have been Nicholas Holt because he's 30 years younger than Tom Cruise.
That's exactly what happened. McQuarrie had cast Nicholas Holt, and then scheduling conflicts got in the way, so he cast this guy as Gabriel. When he saw that Issa Morales was about the same age as Tom Cruise, he's like, I could do something with that. So it was a rewrite. He wrote this as a result of that recast, and God, does it hurt this.
And you can tell, like, it's yes. Clearly his role in the story, it feels like a complete overhaul because the entity working with, like, a young, like, tech bro type of agent, which Nicholas Holt could totally play.
Oh, yeah.
And I was really excited when he was cast because I thought... The guy's got a tremendous amount of range, as we've talked about in the shows, because he's been in a lot of franchises we've covered.
Yep.
And in fact, we'll talk about him as Lex Luthor very soon.
Mm-hmm.
But I could totally see him as the younger, like more the new age type of spy, which even the Craig Bond films never really gave him that type of counterpart, which I think was a certain missed opportunity. So I would have really liked to see him. I don't buy him kicking ass as much as I would Issa Morales, because I've seen Morales play Deathstroke. I think he would have been much more of a interesting, like, charismatic final boss, because Morales is a blank slate. He's not a bad actor, because I really liked him in Ozark.
Yo, he was great in Ozark. In fact, that's what McQuarrie saw to make him cast him in this.
They saved the shittiest villain for the last movie.
I know.
And that's a huge problem. And this was, look, if you're going to rewrite it, and I've said this multiple times throughout the series, get Tom Cruise's true equal in either star power or age. This totally could have been Kurt Russell.
Well, McQuarrie toyed with doing de-aging for this scene. He toyed with, okay, who was just as big as Tom Cruise back in 1989? Oh, it was Julia Roberts. So I want to cast Julia Roberts in this Marie role, and I'm going to de-age them. And of course, he saw that that would balloon the budget, which I didn't think there were any concerns about a ballooning budget when I saw the numbers on this thing. And he was like, and he ixnayed that. So he decided to film it in these shadows and things, but goddamn, it just doesn't work. Narrative-wise, this doesn't work for me. I just find it to be bullshit that, you know, I'm not going to say it's as drastic as Spider-Man 3, which we'll talk about in 10 years, but...
No, it's not that. It's not that.
But no, no, no. Very, but what it...
This is very close to Spectre level of retconning.
Spectre is exactly what I thought of, too.
Problem of that that I have, and y'all both nailed the majority of it, whatever this story was supposed to be, whatever this character was supposed to be, whatever this scene was supposed to be that we see throughout, it was redone, one, by the time they finished this movie, two, by the time they decided they were going to split this movie, and three, by the time they decided they were going to spend 2 years to put out the next movie and delay this even more. This is rewrite. This has got ADR all over it. I like Issa Morales. To Matt's point, I really liked him as Deathstroke. I think he's one of the fucking only good things about that show. Titans, don't watch it, people. But how many times do we get dialogue when the mouth is in shadow? Every time that happens, it's ADR. Every time there's dialogue without looking at the person's face, it's ADR. And it's not good. They change it, they mix it up. And it to do this at the end, when you know this is a final send-off, it's bad. It's dumb. It's a distraction. If you take it out, you're not losing anything. Have this guy just be somebody who's corrupted that goes to take out Ethan because he's the only thing that could stop it. That's all you need. We don't need to have, I don't know, was this his wife, girlfriend? We don't know. It's dumb. The only thing you could have done to make this happen, and I think I said this a week or two ago, make this Emilio. That 30 years later, he is still trying to get revenge on Ethan Hunt.
But you're trying to tell me he survived that fucking spike in the head in the first one?
Hey, what if he's behind it? He was the computer guy, right? Yeah,
you're right.
What if he's been behind everything all along?
Look, that would have been a stretch, but I hate to say this for the sake of comparison. I would have preferred it. Now, that doesn't make it inherently good, but if it would have been at least more of a through line to tie everything together than just pulling this out of nowhere. And you can tell it was also a reshoot or a retooling because the only times you see Morales in those flashbacks are close-up shots. I doubt he's the guy holding the gun from those medium shots. Could have been Nicholas Holt, but maybe it's a scene that happens a year beforehand versus what if he killed Michelle Monaghan?
Mm-hmm.
You know where my mind went, guys? Adam, you mentioned Skynet. I thought this was like the personification of the entity where it was like a robot who fed on all of Ethan Hunt's fears and he was here to hunt him down. My mind went to some crazy places while watching this the first time.
Oh, so he was basically the T-1000?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Why not? But the problem also with doing this is that you've already done his dark reflection with Solomon Lane. And you've already done with John Lark / Walker his true like doppelganger or polar opposite in how they operate. This is a huge step down. Like for your climactic installment, things have to escalate. Fuck it. Too bad there's no way that they couldn't have kept Cavill alive. Just make this Solomon Lane again.
Yeah, such great villains these last two films.
Especially because now you've gotten into, this is one long story, 5 through 8. It's one continuity. Mm-hmm. Just keep the same villain. If you're going to keep everything else, he's still alive. How many times has Blofeld escaped prison in the Fleming novels?
That's what happens when you write yourself into a corner. Like you killed everybody and then you got to do it. But then again, okay, this is just, it's a computer virus. It's AI. It's a computer. The protagonist should be Luther at this point. What the fuck is Tom Cruise going to do against a computer? This is...
After the hook to the face and him falling down that mountain and being in the midst of an explosion, that would have just been too far if you brought Cavill back.
No, but you still had Solomon Lane get captured by MI6.
Yeah, Lane I could have gone with.
Yeah. Like he could have been, because they mentioned he was Swiss intelligence. What if he was the one who created the entity? And it makes sense why he would be like the chosen one for the entity versus this guy who we've never heard about.
Well, MI9, the re-reckoning.
Ethan's told the stakes of his mission have never been higher. The government is searching for a key, and his concern should be the involvement of Ilsa Frost, and why she has chosen it is uncertain. Yet there's a bounty on her head, and he needs to acquire the key and deliver it to the IMF before Ilsa does. So we cut to the Arabia Desert as Ethan finds Ilsa with her huge-ass fucking binoculars. She spots him, as do other people at the desert, and is shot at. So Ethan makes his way through, what else? A sandstorm. I feel like they can't go here without a fucking sandstorm, as Ilsa takes a few guards out, but her hut is invaded, and she is shot. We think she's dead, but stay tuned.
All right, so one thing I'll say, McQuarrie still knows how to shoot action. This is a pretty damn good gunfight. I like that they gave her fucking Deathstroke's eye patch for no reason. I thought that was a nice aesthetic. But I think they're kind of, by this point, you could see they're running out of ideas because this is the second Mission Impossible movie involving a sandstorm after Ghost Protocol.
Exactly, yeah.
And I think it's John Wick 3 has... A part in the desert where he's on horseback. It's one of the John Wick sequels. So I think they're kind of running out of ideas, which it is understandable given you're on the 7th movie in an action franchise. There's only so many set pieces, but look, Bond made 25 movies.
And repeated a lot of the same set pieces.
Oh, it absolutely did. Yeah. But after a pretty first 20 minutes, I'm not with this movie. This kind of won me back. Like it kind of, like, okay, I'm not panicking yet. But I was upset when I thought she died.
Yeah, me too.
All of that. I felt like they were rehashing, but I think it looks beautiful. Though chasing on horses and everything through the desert, it's that whole you can't shoot somebody right in front of you shit that makes me laugh. But I'm into this. It looks great. Ilsa taking people out. I'm glad to see her back. She looks phenomenal. It's a good action piece. I feel like I'm playing Uncharted through some of this. It's just, it's kinetic, and I don't think anything in the movie leading up to it was. I hate the submarine sequence. I hate the Uber Eat driver. The explanation of why we got to get Ilsa, I don't understand. But once we get here, oh, I think this is great. I'm finally sucked in. You could have just started here. Like, you could have started the movie with this sequence, then flashback to him getting the mission so we understand why. And I think the movie would have been stronger for it. They're repeating shit for a fucking movie that's over 2.5 hours. You know how you make this better? You cut it. You do 2 2-hour movies. You don't do 2 3-hour movies.
Well, also, it doesn't make any sense because the last movie ended with her clearing her name, literally getting her ledger cleaned up because she handed Solomon Lane over to MI6. So why is she on the run again and all of the world governments are trying to kill her?
You guys have both mentioned the runtime. We're only about 20 minutes into the film, but we've already seen about 2 or 3 scenes that we could have cut and a whole storyline that we could have cut out of this thing. I was really checking my watch when I saw this in theaters the first time, and these things could have easily been cut.
Dear ChatGP entity, please trim this movie down 30%.
No shit.
Well, it's just the problem with modern action movies in that it almost feels like a mandate that these have to be 2.5 hours. So fill them however you have to, as long as you meet the runtime, because we want to make people feel like they're getting their money's worth. That part I understand with how expensive movie tickets are and all that kind of stuff, but I want quality versus quantity. Because this summer we had Fast X, which I thought was too goddamn long. Dial of Destiny was 2.5 hours. None of these movies justified their runtimes.
Nope.
Nope. And that's not to say you can't have great 2.5 hour action movies, because we'll be talking about a franchise very soon that runs over 2 hours routinely, and I don't feel it. So it can be done. But the problem is, I feel like the action scenes in this movie, as good as they are, they go on too long because they need to stretch out the runtime, because there's very few plot developments to keep it at a justifiable 2.5 hour runtime.
And I do think this is a problem with almost every single movie that came out starting in fall of 2020 when theaters opened back up. Through 2024, I feel like every studio and every exec felt like they no longer had to trim down a movie. And guess what? They are wrong.
Yeah, because I think studios adopted the streaming mentality of, well, if people will sit through, like what James Cameron talks about, people will sit through a 6-hour show, no questions asked, and just get up to go to the bathroom. They'll sit through a 3-hour movie. But it's a totally different environment. Like, it, to me, they're not. Watching something at home is not comparable to watching it in the theater.
This movie feels like, you guys mentioned streaming services. This movie feels like a rebellion against streaming services when you look at the plot of it.
Well, yeah, this and Maverick are basically Tom Cruise's mantra of the movie-going experience works best in the theater. And I fully endorse that, but if you're going to keep me in there and basically in total darkness for 3 hours, I don't want to feel like I'm checking my watch every 45 minutes.
Yep.
Not that I did that for this movie, but I don't think there's a justification for this to be damn near 3 hours. The last one absolutely did. Although that one was closer to 2.5 than 3.
So we are hearing about the entity as we cut to a roundtable meeting and we see Cary Elwes.
Right away I knew he was the villain.
Yeah. I mean, that was my very next note. Like, anyone else not?
This fucking guy has forgotten how to act.
I don't think he ever did know.
What has happened. I don't know what the fuck has happened to Cary Elwes, where when he plays villains, there is no undercurrent of ambiguity. If you saw Saw 3D, which I know that's a weird comparison, he comes back after being gone the whole series, and it's so obvious he's in on it and is the new apprentice. Here, it's the same thing, because the way he delivers his lines, there's like this trail of slime throughout his sentences. And right down to his mannerisms, the way he kind of like cocks his head and acts all high and mighty. I think the guy has forgotten how to act. Look, Princess Bride was, what, 40 years ago? Yeah.
I tell you what, man, if he had a Henry Cavill mustache, he'd be twirling it in this fucking movie. That's how slimy he comes off.
And I think with that, I think he's a good pull for the role, though. I think he's perfect for any government official. I was surprised to see him in here, and I think he's a good get. I think he's perfect for what he's asked to do. But I, with that, don't think there's any surprises either. I don't think we're meant to think like Kittredge. Do we know what side he's playing on?
Speaking of, I was shocked to see Kittredge come back.
Yeah, I was just getting there. Yep. So we're hearing how the entity has invaded the world and how it came and went, leaving no fingerprints to where it can easily be found. We then hear that they are powerless to stop it and that the entire intelligence community are fearing the breach of their constructions and turn their allies into enemies. It is an enemy that is everywhere and nowhere at the same time. And here we have Kittredge. I love seeing him back. And my God, he hasn't aged a day, has he?
Well, considering it's been 25 years, he's actually aged pretty well. Yeah, but I thought this was a cool callback that he's, now that we're tying everything together, the guy, it makes sense to bring him back. Especially now that he's the current director of the CIA with Alec Baldwin, both dying, taking over the IMF, and then Angela Bassett, who's not in this movie,
nope,
who was the CIA director in the previous movie. So as we'll find out in the next movie, boy, she got a promotion.
Well, we find out here because we see a picture on the wall where she's...
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
But I thought this was that. Yeah, it's in the room, mm-hmm, behind...
Okay.
So at least that's a clever tease, actually.
Nice. Yeah.
It's weird to see subtle storytelling in this movie because there's not a whole lot of it. Because this scene, they should have called this movie Mission Exposition. Holy shit, is there so much info that is just, like, it is a diuretic explosion of information that would make Christopher Nolan go, hey, let's calm down. It is ridiculous how much they just shovel down your throat. And all they say is, hey, all you have to say is, it's AI. It can do whatever it wants. It's sentient. That's all you need.
Well, to go back to the picture of Bassett, that they did that out of necessity because she was supposed to be here, but COVID restrictions didn't allow her to travel.
I feel like this scene is kind of needed, though, with everything we've got up to this point. And I like what happens. I like what happens in this room. I like the actors we get. And I like when we have what looks like Rami Malek with this fucking mask that Tom Cruise has shows up. I'm like, man, I didn't know Rami Malek was switching franchises. I kind of dig the scene. I think it was needed. I think it goes on a little long. And I think you could, as we say, you could have cut shit to make this flow better. But at least we're caught up. But I do think, by trying to give a reason to this entity, I'm offended that you think I'm this stupid, that you're basically trying to, like, God mode this AI. I'm just like, this is fucking stupid. And I understand that somebody at the Scientology Center Hollywood thought this was a great fucking idea when they wrote the script, but it's stupid.
Also, you have a built-in excuse to deliver exposition with his mission briefings.
Which is what they are.
Yeah, but you could have condensed that information when Ethan Hunt gets his DoorDash delivery.
Yep.
So we see this, as Adam calls him, Rami Malek looking agent just leaning against the wall. And we hear more exposition about a race going on for the two halves of the key for global dominance.
Speaking of Dial of Destiny, it's we have to get the two pieces
yes.
of the thing. They merge together yes. to... but also you can tell this is part one because they don't explain exactly what the key unlocks, because I don't think the writers fucking know.
We hadn't decided. Yep.
We hear that a buyer going through the Middle East who Kittredge believes has one half of the key. The other half is in the hands of Ilsa, who's now dead and killed by mercenaries, or so they believe. Kittredge says that he doesn't know if Ethan has the other half because he hasn't reported back yet. And then Kittredge is given a box, which he opens, and Joker style, he's given a mask as green gas is deployed and the rest of the room is taken out.
Yeah, it should have come with the post-it note that said, put this on right now.
Right?
Also, nobody sees him open that fucking mask and say, hey, what's that for?
The other agent pulls off his mask, and it's Ethan. So we get an Ethan Kittredge reunion as we get a call back to the you are upset line from the first one. Kittredge says that he put a bounty on Ilsa's head, but she wasn't supposed to find the key. And then we cut to Ethan holding Ilsa, telling her everything will be okay. And Ethan just tells her to stay dead. And by the way, this movie, so many fucking flashbacks. In the middle of this big scene between Ethan and Kittredge, we got to have a flashback to Ethan and Ilsa.
Yeah, because by doing this, you also remove any intrigue about her being dead.
Exactly.
So you kill her mm-hmm. off, and then 5 minutes later, you find out it's a ruse. So it doesn't have any immediate staying power. And then when you, spoiler alert, kill her off for real, there's no reason for me to believe that she's
exactly.
not...
It takes away that power. Yep. Kittredge says that he's not going to apologize as he always completes his missions. Ethan shows Kittredge the key, and Kittredge says that the next world war is right around the corner. Whoever controls the war controls the world, and Ethan needs to pick a side. Ethan tells Kittredge to stay out of his way, but Kittredge says one way or another, this mission will cost Ethan dearly. Kittredge answers the phone, where he's told that there's a situation in that the adjacent was found drugged, yet security has him entering the building 15 minutes ago. Kittredge hangs up and is shot by a dart that knocks him out, and we have our opening credits at 28 minutes, boys.
Such a Bond move. This thing wants
well,
to
no,
be Bond
was at, the most Bond had was 20. This is 28.
Yep, yep.
Mm. And 20 minutes of it could have been cut or condensed. like so. Yeah. I remember I saw this with a friend, and I turned to him and I said, if this is the whole movie, we're in trouble.
We cut to an airbase. Boy, funny seeing this a year after Maverick, as we hear that Ethan is being hunted and is expendable. We cut to Benji, who is amazed at the entity's power and expresses it to Luther and Ethan. Ethan goes over the plan, which is to sell the other half to a certain buyer so that Ethan can follow the key wherever it goes. Finding the completed key is just the beginning.
So I'm happy that it's the three of them together again, because these are the three I care about the most of anybody in the series. Before this, we meet Shea Whingham's character. And my problem with this is that it's doing the same thing Ghost Protocol did, where we have a government operative running to track him down. The difference is he's American, and there's that line about, like, he knows him or something. Like, he says it's personal. Now, I had no idea what that was going to lead to, if that would mean much of anything. But this is the same fucking thing he did in Fast and Furious. Not that Garrett remembers those movies.
I don't. I know. I remember a scene later on that made me think of Fast 10. But
so in Fast and Furious, he plays Brian's superior with the FBI.
Okay.
So when Brian goes rogue, he goes after him.
All right. All right. I remember him now.
It's the same goddamn thing.
It drives me nuts because in this movie, when I'm watching it, I'm like, he's been in this series before, right? He's been around the whole time. No, it wasn't this fucking series. But it makes me, there's a line in this that I don't think is accidental, and I can't help but just pop huge when he talks about how you need to drive a stake through his heart. And for somebody who watched Interview with a Vampire in movie theaters, calling Tom Cruise a fucking vampire just makes me laugh.
But it's also like, by this point, he might as well be Jesse James with the amount of mysticism around his agency, where they kind of do this with the trailers for the new one, where it's like, oh, is it true we bombed the Kremlin? He's become the spy equivalent of Paul Bunyan, which I think is pretty cool. But I'm tired of all the Christ metaphors, right down to the goddamn, I shouldn't say goddamn, talking about Jesus, but the key is literally a crucifix.
Cross, yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
I was like, for God's sake, how much more grandstanding can you include? We get it. He's the IMF, and the M stands for Messiah.
He does have a complex.
Oh, he most certainly does. We move on to the airport as we see Gabriel in all white set down a suspicious bag, and we see the force go after Ethan. They stop a guy in a blue suit, but it's not Ethan. I love them suspecting that this is a mask. This is kind of fun
stuff.
Yes.
But I hate how incompetent these cops are.
Oh, God, yeah.
Like, oh, yeah, like you can play the Benny Hill music.
Yeah, like, they make the guys in Ghost Protocol look like the cold killers that Daniel Craig was in Casino Royale. These guys are one step away from being the cops from Last House on the Left.
Oh, Christ. What a reference. They say they got him again as Ethan sees the buyer and Benji gets him on the flight. Ethan spots a woman picking the buyer's pocket, which is where the key is. Benji is asking if there's a bomb on the plane, and the woman is identified as someone with quite the history. Benji goes after the bag as Ethan approaches who will eventually find out is Grace, played by Agent Carter herself, Haley Atwell. All right, boys, another new addition to the series, another new female to the series. How do we feel about Grace?
We need to ask. I mean, one, I think she's a good addition to it, but when she shows up, I know that Ilsa's not going to stick around. It's just the way that this friend, you know, it you might as well have circled the fucking crows. But I think she's playful, I think she's fun, I think she's a great addition to it, and I think she looks fantastic. And I don't mean just like physicality wise, like that's a duh, but I think she just fits in here, and just she brings some energy to this movie that it's desperately needed so far. But she's Catwoman in this franchise now, and she's fucking fun. I think she's a good get.
Right down to, she is Anne Hathaway's Catwoman.
Mm-hmm.
I think to Adam's point about meaning Ilsa was going to get the shaft, that was inevitable, because in a lot of these big franchises, and this is sad to say, it's like you can't have two strong female leads at the same time. You have to, only one can survive, which I think is a mistake. She's a welcome addition, because this movie, to its benefit, unlike the last two movies, this one has a lot more comedy injected into it, which I do think is, I think it's a welcome addition. I think it's incorporated pretty well. And a lot of it comes from her having no idea the level of shit she's getting involved in.
Yeah, I gotta say that this is the first movie since the second one that does not have the Bad Robot logo in front of it. And I always thought that Abrams himself was the one who injected a lot of the lightheartedness, a lot of the comedy. I laughed quite a bit last week too, but here there is a more lightheartedness even given the Dredd plot, and I do welcome that as well. So Cruz does the old taking off the glasses trick as he interrogates Grace and even does the magic sleight of hand that we saw in the first film.
Yeah, he does the David Caruso.
Yes. David Caruso. Oh,
You know he uses this as a move to pick up chicks or dudes. He doesn't know.
Yeah, but they always say, hey, stand up. I can't see you.
Grace says that she's working solo, but Ethan says that she will be partnered today. He says that if she wants the money, he can give it to her. He tells her to keep the lighter as something to remember him by. Luther tells Ethan that the alloy and the key doesn't match, but Ethan says that doesn't change the objective. Meanwhile, this dumb task force that Matt pointed out can't find Ethan. Ethan tells Grace that if he tells her to run, she needs to do so. Benji opens the bag and finds a device inside. He takes it out as Luther identifies the buyer. The place will be crawling with agent at any time as Benji activates the bomb and has 5 minutes to deactivate it. Benji.
Oh, the Riddler device?
Oh my god. Benji reveals a cylinder wheel that spins a message that you are done, D-U-N-N, and it knows who he is. And as Matt mentioned, we get Riddler messages, and he answers correctly until another message, are you afraid of death? Luther figures out what it's doing as he asks Ethan a riddle, which Grace answers, as Ethan asks what's happening. Ether takes her around as Benji answers more riddles until 45 seconds ticks down. Benji asks why they always end up in these situations as the cylinder keeps ticking down and it opens, revealing nothing as Grace walks away with the real key.
All right, so I'm not a bloodthirsty ECW fan who calls for people's heads and I'm just insatiable, but this was the perfect moment to kill off Benji.
I thought the same thing.
And if they did it, it would have been both shocking, but raised the stakes without me feeling like they're just fridging him. Like, this would have actually had some weight. It would have showed just how bloodthirsty or how smart the entity was that he took out the smartest guy on the team. And it would have had some resonance because for a part one, you could have actually had time to mourn him, which they try to do later on and it doesn't work. I think this was a huge missed opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, I like him. I'm glad he's around. I think he's been great, but you're running out the series. Like, this would have been the way to do it. But I do not like this entire, would you like to play a game way that this is fucking done down here. Oh, god damn.
Yeah, but and if there was a puppet on a tricycle, you would have loved it.
By the way, the way Adam did that, it almost felt like War Games. Like, that wasn't Saw, that was War Games.
What it was meant to be, but it actually works both ways.
So Ethan sees Gabriel in front of him as he takes off his glasses and he terminates the mission on the spot. Ethan is then spotted and a chase is on. He finds Grace and knocks on the glass as he escapes the agents. Ethan then gets on the glass roof as the agents say that he's got to be here somewhere. The bumbling agents that Matt pointed out earlier.
Can I say, I really like that this is fucking around with their technology, though. This part I think is cool that, you know, they're tracking somebody, but it's not them. That it, though, again, this is just deep fake technology. So it's not out there, but to do it in real time, fuck them around. But other than the cops in this airport, have you all ever been to an airport since 2001? They fucking have the lay of this place.
We see Grace being interrogated with all counts against her. And she says that she's never seen any of the counts against her. And all the passports are not her. She says she's obviously made some powerful enemies, as she's told that her lawyer is there.
I have a problem with this interrogation because everyone who works in law enforcement in this movie is a fucking idiot who breaks protocol. You would not let her touch anything.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that, and she grabs the paperclip because I'm like, of course it's there. But I feel like all of these cops were taught by Bobcat Goldthwait. And I do like Tom Cruise as the lawyer. Like, that's a nice, like, The Firm reference.
Yeah.
Yep.
Grace has walked out as Gabriel trails her and walks in and asks about the key that she had. Gabriel says that he can be anything and he knows everything as he stabs this guy's hand. Aw.
I hate how all of his dialogue is just pontificating.
Yep, and this is what made me think that he was a personification of AI. Ethan welcomes Grace in while speaking French, and we're hearing about Grace's attempts to take the key to the highest bidder as she grew up in poverty where she honed her skills as a thief. They negotiate for a bit, as she says that she has no idea who hired her. She says there was a picture of him in her instructions to follow him at the airport, and she was instructed to deliver it to Venice. Ethan leaves with Grace as a trail of green gas is left. Grace gets in an elevator and heads down. She jumps in an open police car and takes off as cops follow her. Ethan then gets on his old trusted motorcycle and a chase is on. Grace displays some road rage. Who the hell parks like that? As Ethan asks her to pull over and tell her that he's there to help her. She crashes as the airbag deploys and she's approached by another agent and Ethan gets her out.
This scene, I'm going to cut you right there. This scene where she crashes and everything goes silent.
Yes.
This is a really cool. I wish there was, I don't know if I need more of this, but I wish maybe there was less of the rest of the movie so that this stuck out. This rescues some of the scene that was, oh, it was okay. This is cool. It is silent. You see the visuals going on. You feel it from her perspective, even though it's not first person, just because of how it pulls back a little bit. This is some really cool shit of what happens right here. For a car chase that I feel like we've seen four times in the last couple years, you know, between this, between Fast and the Furious, between Bond, like, I feel like we're in the same city over and over and over and over. It does something cool here at the end, and I appreciate it for it.
Because we literally are, because this and Fast X both destroy Rome.
Yeah, but this is more intimate than Fast X, and I do like this better. Even though we saw this scene a month before when Fast X was out, I like this better. I don't know.
Well, this is I also like the dynamic of them being handcuffed to each other.
Yes,
and this is where you implement the comedy pretty well with the fact they're driving this beat up little Beetle for all intents and purposes.
It's a fucking Fiat, dude.
Yeah,
they have really good chemistry. And this is when I think it shows that when Tom is not trying to put on the fake I love women act, he's just got some really good chemistry with his female co-stars. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel nothing romantic about these two, but fuck, they play well together.
No, I like how their dynamic in this movie is strictly platonic, which all of the other ones, they've kind of hinted at that. I mean, the worst is Tandy Newton, of course. Obviously, he's been married. You know, Michelle Monaghan's like, hey, I did my return. See you later. Not coming back for these last two. So I like this. I think it's needed. And to McCoy's credit, it's this third car chase, and he's done something different every time.
And yeah. I'm with Adam. I think the absence of sound really adds to this as well.
No, I disagree. I think it's impressive. It's frustrating because, you know, this movie undercuts itself so much, I think, by just rewriting and re-editing, that you get some really cool shit like this. And I love it. And then, you know, it lasts whatever it is, 5, 10, 15 minutes, and then the movie just slaps you across the face again.
So the agents catch up to them and ask Ethan to put on the cuffs. And then we see this blonde assassin who will come to know as Paris show up and take out the law enforcement. Ethan and Grace are cuffed as they get in a car. Ethan makes another mistake, asking the woman to drive.
Wow.
Sorry.
Hey, you just say that because, you know, your fiance is the same size as Tom Cruise.
A few inches shorter.
But also, the thing that I love about this movie, Grace is what Helena wanted to be.
Paris gets in an armored car. We have another chase driving through the streets of Venice. We see this domino effect of bikes being hit. Grace says that she's not doing this anymore and tells Ethan to drive. He gets in the driver's seat as Grace asks who the woman is. And I love how these streets aren't clear. There are cars, scooters, anything else you see on the road that's in the way. And then Ethan takes her to a yellow Fiat. Boy, I love this. I love how the door won't close. I love how Ethan is having trouble turning the car on. This is good stuff. Good comedy, as Matt mentioned earlier.
Well, it's also a funny callback to Ghost Protocol where nothing works like it should.
Mm-hmm.
I love that, but I like that he, you know, he's able to bring up on his thing that this is a IMF car. Because he's like, you know, bring up a safe car. You know, he's asking for their stuff here. So this is something that's, you know, staged much like, I don't know, I assume random cars, weapons, safe houses and shit. Like, this is pre-planned, but it still doesn't work because he's like, what the hell is this?
You're seeing these windshield wipers and he's running a red light. They are still being pursued by cops, but Paris comes in and hits them in her armored car. And I mentioned earlier, but God, this chase is so much better than Fast 10 in my eyes. They're going
It also beats the shit out of the chase and Dial of Destiny.
They're going downstairs, tumbling. Paris gets stuck as the tires on the Fiat are out. They're driving round and round as they hit a tunnel, and they keep going through streets and alleys until they hit a blockade. Paris is heading toward them too, so Ethan tells Grace to hit it, and they scrape by into a tunnel and crash. Grace gets out and says, "Don't hate me," as she shows him the paperclip that she escaped with as a train hits the car and Ethan jumps out. And boy, Adam, you must have had some bad flashbacks here with this train coming and just plowing into it.
Oh, so close.
Yeah.
Been there.
Ethan's still walking around with the steering wheel as Benji pulls up, and he looks in the van and sees Ilsa up front. They're in a boat as they head to a safe house. It seems like a lot of these movies, like even the last movie, when they were grabbing Solomon Lane, Ethan's getting to this chase and he tumbles down and he lands in a boat where they have Lane in the front seat. Same thing here. Like he just ends up on a boat and there they are.
Yeah, I feel like they're using it as a transition moment. Yeah, you know, it's exactly. Almost like in a video game. It's a transition screen.
Benji tells them that the White Widow, who is going to be meeting Grace with the key. And I love how we get these references to the last movie with how Ethan worked out the price on his head, which was cool. They still don't know what the key unlocks, and the AR, as you guys have mentioned, they probably didn't know in the writer's room as well, and the AR sunglasses he was wearing showed the only person who has no identity. Anyone else think he was a computer of some kind? I did.
I mean, it wouldn't have been that absurd, but it never fully crossed my mind that he was an artificial being. Mm. That would have been too much of a stretch for this series.
Yep.
Ethan says that the entity must be protecting him, and we get the backstory of how Ethan thought Gabriel was someone who died a long time ago, and it was him who made Ethan who he is now.
Emphasis on now, because we've never talked about this before.
God, that pissed me off. Ilsa calls him the entity's chosen messenger. And then Ilsa says that attempts to stop the entity would be seen as an act of treason, but she beat Gabriel to the key he was after, and she hid in the desert after Kittredge put a bounty on her head. She says that the key might unlock the entity's source code, so Ethan concludes that since she contacted her friends through electric means, they must assume it was the entity who provided her with the information. And this is the part of this enemy that I do like. You know, you can't go through electronic means because it would know.
That's fine, but we've already seen them overcome bad technology, so I don't feel like it's that much of a challenge, per se.
Ethan then says that he knows that Gabriel knows how to get to him, which is through them, his friends. Luther says Ethan is playing four-dimensional chess with an algorithm, and if he wants to beat the entity, he needs to think like it. Luther then says that Gabriel cannot have the key, and none of their lives mean more than this mission. Ilsa tells Ethan that it's her first time in Venice. Bullshit. He says it's his too, and they hug for some reason. Cut to another boat as Ethan grabs her hand, and we go back to a club like the last film. Gabriel offers to buy Grace a drink as she spots Paris. He then says he knows how her story ends. So we see the agents from earlier. They head to the party. Gabriel tells Grace of Marie, the woman from Ethan's past, and the only thing standing in his way is her. Ethan and Ilsa show up, as does Paris, but the White Widow also shows up to say hi to John Lark, as well as Gabriel.
So that speech, though, has the worst writing contradiction in the entire series. Because he talks about how Ethan will put himself over his team, which is the direct antithesis of the whole point of the opening of the last movie.
Everybody in... That's what we learned. Like, the secretaries know that he's always going to put the team first. That's why he's a risk, because he doesn't put the mission above his team. And if everybody else knows that, the entity sure as hell should know that. This is like a rejected Dan Brown script. This is like some of his absolute stupidest books, but written even worse. Like, this explanation, again, this is like now the third or fourth time we got to get an explanation of the entity, and I guess they hope that means that it's going to sink in with the audience. Oh, god damn.
You also don't have the excuse of oversight, because it's the same creative team coming back, yeah. So they can't even follow their own continuity.
The White Widow gives a dark stare toward Grace, who she says she handpicked. Grace is given a security check, but they don't find the key. When the White Widow asks where it is, Grace says that it's in the last place you think to look. The White Widow says that the world is changing and the key is the one thing with the power to control the entity. Ilsa says that no matter who has the key, she will be looked at as the world's enemy, as Ethan hears the entity, and the White Widow says that the plot thickens. God damn. You know, I was going to use this as my summarization, but I'm going to put this out there right now. I think I'm more with this movie than you guys. I'm having a better time with it as it's going. But to make this movie all about getting this key, you have slowed it to a grinding halt. We have no idea what this thing opens. And this movie is 2 hours and 45 minutes of getting this fucking thing.
Well, this movie is very similar to the second Pirates movie, in that it's part one of a two-part conclusion, and they're both about getting keys to unlock something that can beat the antagonist. The difference is there is no Davy Jones to anchor this movie. Mm-hmm. And also, I don't find Ethan all that interesting in this movie, because this one is really going on to the chosen one, almost divine fate level of his escapades, which I find just we're laying it on really thick. And I'm sorry, I just can't take all this seriously with all the pontificating about the AI and how it literally presents itself. It might as well show up like a Princess Leia hologram and talk to them through a projector.
And I don't want to insult someone's belief, but this feels like fucking L. Ron Hubbard wrote this script from the dead. Like, this is, oh my God, technology is this evil thing that's going to make you feel bad. But this messiah complex, I think they had an idea. And by trying to stretch it, water it down, and pontificate of just the meaning of self, it's dumb. And I understand you want to be worried about AI, but they can't even get that shit right. Like, it's topical, but you fuck up the way you do it. And you keep losing me every time you bring me back in. And this wannabe John Wick fucking rave bar that they're at is just, oh, look, the entity logo fucking showing up in screens. It's just, no, no.
White Widow, a.k.a. Alana, accuses Grace of knowing where the other half is, but Ethan says that she can't because she doesn't know what it unlocks. Gabriel says that he will have the key as the future is all but assured given the entity knows everything. Gabriel then makes a promise that if one of the women die, then he will be gone with the key as it is written. Ethan says if he completes the key, he will kill the entity, but Alana won't budge as Gabriel says that he will make Ethan choose which one dies for old time's sake. Ethan says
we are literally resorting to the cliche of you can only pick one to save.
This is Batman Forever, right?
Pretty much.
Holy shit, yeah.
Not just because we have a Mrs. Tom Cruise in that.
Yeah, but. Right?
But yeah, I thought this franchise was above these tropes.
I did too.
And I don't turn on this movie ever. Like, I'm not going to give this a bad score because I think there are some good things about it. But I do think you're seeing the problem of maybe they should have quit while they were ahead and just made Fallout the last movie. Because I feel like they're trying to top themselves and they're overcompensating to the detriment of the movie.
Much like Matt, and I agree. Are we blasting this movie? Yes, but we are blasting the script specifically, the dialogue specifically. Like, it feels like they had points and they used AI to fill in the points. Like, I truly believe that this was not written by a guy sitting down at his computer. And I think it's pretty obvious, you know, and maybe they tried to do that as a meta take on what this is, but it's inexcusable. But at the same time, there's parts of this shit that I'm enjoying. I do.
I'm trying to get what you did enjoy. With the exception of the car chase, Adam, you haven't really mentioned much that you've enjoyed. What have you enjoyed throughout this first hour and a half or so?
I guess the camaraderie of this team, of like what they're putting in place, but what they're going after, the reasoning behind it and all that, I think is inexcusably dumb. You know, I do, but I enjoy the team. I enjoy the new characters. I like seeing Palm Clemente show up here, even if she's really just kind of being on a top from Goldeneye, you know, throughout this film.
I think Morales is my comparison again.
Shit. Sorry. But I do think that Morales is just one of those villains because I think they're trying to keep him purposefully unexplored. You don't care that he's your maybe villain, maybe not throughout the entire thing.
Ethan says if one of them dies, even God won't save Gabriel from what Ethan will do to him.
Oh, my fucking, I can't believe he said that.
I can't either. That's why I wrote it down. Ethan tells Alana that she has made a terrible mistake, but she has to be on the train tomorrow with the key. Ethan tells Elsa to run as far as she can as he fights out of the situation. And I love that Grace does the sleight of hand like Ethan did earlier as Ethan jumps down and Grace is confronted by the agents. This was fun stuff.
I thought this franchise was going to conclude with them opening up. You know how the Kingsmen have a tailor shop? They open up a magic shop. I wish the entity controlled Gabriel like a ventriloquist dummy where it literally like manifests a hand and shoves it up his ass. Like that's basically what this is.
Grace fights them off as Ethan calls for eyes to help him get to Grace. And here we have the cruise run, boys. We've been waiting for this. God damn, this guy is in his, what, at the time they filmed this, he was what, 58?
He was the same age as Wilford Brimley was in Cocoon.
Jesus Christ. All right, Canary.
Which, I mean, the fact that you say that is insane. And also, he is the same age that Ian McKellen was on the first Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, but you took my reference.
That's payback for Goldeneye.
I was going to say, you guys are just taking your own references.
Because that was my thing. They make her so exaggerated.
Yes.
They've done this with like Leia Sado, but she was nowhere near as exaggerated as this character is. It feels like a styles clash with the rest of the movie. Like, you can't have both an artificial AI and a hench wench who might as well be dressed up like Harley Quinn.
But I do think she brings a fun energy.
Yeah, but it doesn't belong in this movie.
Yeah, I can't disagree.
We get to a scene that infuriated me. We see that Benji is once again being Ethan's GPS, and he's telling him where Grace is, but somehow the entity has intercepted the frequency and leads him to a dead end as Benji destroys his laptop to try getting to Ethan. Why Ethan could not recognize this as not being Benji fucking infuriates me.
What infuriates me is that they have facial recognition cameras when it's convenient in this movie. And if you have this entity that's already infiltrated anything, all they would have to do to be recognized is step outside or inside or anywhere.
The thing that frustrated me was that they kill Elsa momentarily. That's where I...
All right, we're getting there. So the entity says that Ethan is now done and Grace is headed to Gabriel. We see a fight between Grace and Gabriel on a bridge as Paris comes after Ethan in this alley. He's cornered as Grace is knocked down. Ethan fights out of her scissors and knocks her against a wall. He hits above her head with a bar, taking off, and we see Grace fall down some stairs. And here comes Elsa, though we have another fight. It goes on for a bit. We have some overhead shots. As he knocks her down, he throws her against a wall, and as Ethan is still running through alleys, Elsa is stabbed and left for dead. This time she's dead, unlike earlier in the film. All right, Matt, go ahead.
They are all dead.
Yeah. Matt, you didn't like this decision to kill her, huh?
No, because it's just, oh, we can only have one. Get rid of the other. And it's a double beat.
Although, here's what I'll say about this decision. I'll agree, you know, he does have some good chemistry with Hayley Atwell's character. So I'm kind of conflicted about this, though. Unless Ferguson was like, you know what, I'm an actor and fuck these big budget messes, I'm out of here.
I don't know. I don't know if she, yeah, well, that's true. But I don't think she's leaving this to go make the Snowman 2 second winter.
But she, I feel in her interviews that I've listened to, like she doesn't take these as seriously as, say, Tom Cruise does. I mean, who does? But she feels like somebody who was in this to collect a paycheck. And this just looks like she went to McQuarrie and said, I will be in your little film. Just kill me off.
I think maybe that they decided that they were killing somebody in the team, but they were never going to kill Luther or Benji. I think that made her expendable. I don't like the choice just because I think she has brought out some of the best in the series just by what she does and her presence. But I don't fault it from a story standpoint other than they don't know what her and Ethan are. They kind of make it look like they were romantic, but maybe not. And maybe it was just teamwork, but maybe not. And I think that has to do with, I mean, come on, let's be honest. This thing was rewritten like 8 fucking times, but I really like this dual fight going on. I think it's kind of crazy that we pull out swords on a, you know,
yeah, yeah. Why is she carrying around a katana? Like her and Paris are both walking around with katanas.
I mean, this is a great, hey, look, I love Forged in Fire, but this shit was, you know, almost a little crazy. The entity could not have predicted this, though I guess it did. But I love this dual fight. I like this alley fight with it being just so close quarters that they can't even fully extend. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that shit's just, it's cool. It's something different. But it shocked me because when she's killed, to me, I don't think there's any way she stays dead. Like, I don't think she's killed because you already pulled this beat. So I guess the surprise is that they actually keep her dead.
We cut to Ethan mourning Ilsa's death as Luther tells Grace that Ilsa is the reason that she is alive. Luther tells her that she has a chance to get out of her situation as her options are now prison or death or the option to come with them and be a ghost. I love seeing this mask of Alana as it's complete and put on Grace. This is fun stuff. Although, I will say this. As much as I like Hayley Atwell in this movie, she cannot act like anybody else. When she does this acting and she eventually gets on this train and she's supposed to have this mask on, I still see Hayley Atwell. I don't feel like she's personifying anybody else.
But I don't think she's an outlier. She's the only person in this whole thing that's not part of this.
Yeah, I think it's an intentional choice.
Okay.
Although it is the problem of, well, we were going to have Ilsa do this, but she's dead. So tag, you're it.
But I feel the same way kind of with Vanessa Kirby. Like, I feel like she walks into and out of every scene looking like her foot just fucking got stuck in an outlet. She looks surprised with every line delivery she gives.
Didn't she just come off a fucking Oscar nomination?
Yeah.
Vanessa Why Kirby? Is she so bad really? In these?
Why is she so bad?
Yeah.
Not in these. She's bad. She's... Get ready, Fantastic Four fans.
We cut to the train as Alana moves around and Ethan takes off the mask of one of the goons. But of course, this is what they hope happens. Ethan tells her that Kittredge will meet her on the train and he trusts Kittredge to know her value. but she has no value unless she goes through with the plan. But Luther says that without a team behind her, her life won't be measured in years, but in hours. Ethan says that he swears that her life means more to him than his own, which I feel is more bullshit. Luther gives Ethan a few gadgets, and he has to work offline to find the entity. He then asks Ethan the question of what his objective is, killing the entity or killing Gabriel. And this is the role that Luther has come to be, right? He's the morale that Ethan needs.
He's his Jiminy Cricket.
I wasn't going to put it like that, but okay. I'm sorry.
I mean, he is. That's a really good, I never put it there, but yeah, he is that. He's that conscience.
Luther, that's also the thing of, hey, I need to leave the movie because we got too many characters.
Well,
yeah, you filmed me separately. I did my 2 weeks. I got to go. Mm-hmm. Why? Because I got to go. Again, this isn't the first time they've done this with Luther either.
Nope.
He's just like, all right, I'm out.
Luther tells Ethan that everyone else wants to control the entity, but Ethan wants to kill it. And it's counting on the outcomes of either Ethan dies on the train or he kills Gabriel. Either thing means that the entity wins. Luther then tells Ethan to get off the train without killing Gabriel or altering the plan. Benji then says that the mask machine is dead. Boy, what have we heard this before? Ethan is forced to go without the mask. Ethan says he needs a curve so that it's going to be slow enough so he can jump on it. He tells Grace to go on without him. Benji tells Grace to not bother with details as they just get in the way, and Ethan promises her that he will be on the train no matter what. We cut to the Alps as Alana is sitting on the train. Paris hops on and makes a heart with her breath on the window, which, okay, this doesn't belong in this movie, but here we go. We see Gabriel is on the train as Ethan gets ready to get in position. Gabriel takes out two train workers as he pulls the brake and blows the whistle, as Grace is able to take Alana out and take the key. She meets up with Kittredge, who questions whether this is actually Alana. Denlinger meets up with Paris and Gabriel as he tells them what the key opens and what exactly happened on that submarine. He also says that he's the only person who knows where the sub is, and this causes Gabriel to kill him and go after Paris, saying that she will betray him because Ethan spared her life. The deal gets on its way to being done, and Kittredge combines the halves, saying that the key will change the world. God, this fucking key. Grace takes the key before the deal is finished, takes off her mask, and tries getting away from Alana's goons. Meanwhile, all right, here we go, boys. This was the stunt that we had built up. I remember in the months leading up to this film, they had pumped up this stunt. This is what Tom Cruise had done, you know, a lot like getting on that airplane in Rogue Nation. He makes that jump that we knew was coming. Now, the jump I have no problems with. I think this is an amazing stunt, as always. However, being able to time which window to jump through at what time makes my fucking head spin.
So yeah, that is a one in a million shot, but I think this, everything from here on out is fucking outstanding. It was worth me sitting through most of this movie to get to this part, because I think this might be my favorite climactic set piece of the series up to this point. Not just because I like the Orient Express, that's a fun thing to set your climax on for a movie this bombastic, but the stunt work of, also the buildup of him climbing the mountain, where mm-hmm. Benji's talking to him. He's like, I am very nervous right now, as he's driving the self-driving car. I think this is all really cool and is the most fun I've had in the movie up to this point.
So leading up to this, we got a couple parts that I thought were self-referencing great. The whole details get in the way. Yeah, that's what the screenwriter said of this film. And then later on, it's just, for reasons we don't know, the AI went rogue. Yeah, that's referencing you trying to write this fucking script. Once we get in here, the car and it being a self-driving car and being scared of it, that is the type of entity knowledge and things it can do that are, I think, would be much better used in this film than the club scene with suddenly seeing it show up and so much of the other stuff. The mask, it should be taken over where the entity destroys the mask generator or makes it into a mask of somebody else. Have it do your old team, something to just fuck with you.
You're saying it should have turned into Katie Holmes.
Oh my God. Nicole Kidman. Your past is in front of you, Ethan.
Actually, that would have been funny if the AI used her voice.
Oh my God.
Oh God. But once we get onto this train, once we get to this buildup, yeah, I forgive a lot of the middle of this film. Or actually, I forgive a lot of maybe the first third of the film, because I think this is a lot of fun. All of us had seen this stunt in movie theaters for months.
Yes.
They played this making of on TV, on the internet, and in front of movies. Now, the stunt itself is fine. I don't think you gain something from a viewer of seeing this stunt. I don't think the practicality of it does anything special unless you're like us and you appreciate it and you've seen it and that. My dad, my wife, so many other people that have seen this film, I don't think you get anything by making this practical. Okay, I saw Batman base jump fucking 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and it looked just as good. But I really admire Tom Cruise for wanting to do this and for basically self-insuring to make sure this got done. It is... Because I have seen this stunt in movie theaters, the lead up to it is a tease for me that I think pays off. Yeah, crashing through the window, that is so video gamey, but the last 20 minutes of this film is taken from Uncharted 2, so I can almost forgive it. Like, it rips that game off fucking whole hog, but this is so fun. This is what I think the rest of the movie needed, and I think you could have edited it to not have the problems. I like this as soon as we get to this train.
Well, they were also smart by showing that stunt multiple times, but not showing what follows it.
Adam hates this movie so much, he's knocking the stunt.
No, I'm not knocking the stunt, but I think if it wasn't practical, I don't think it would affect the way it looks in the film. And I think that 80% of the audience doesn't know what he went through for it.
Yeah, he did this a lot in the lead up to this. So the key falls to the ground as they both ask if the other is okay. But Gabriel picks up the key and Ethan goes after him. He tells Grace to find a way to stop the train. And we get a bit of a callback to the first film as there's a fight on top of the train. And we have some creative avoiding of obstacles that get in the way.
You could say it was a avoidance because it's calling back to the first one.
My fucking God.
The Goudreau, everybody. No, I did like that because I felt like this was specifically acknowledging that first film, and it tipped my hat to it.
Grace heads out to try to stop the train as the fight wages on. Gabriel heads down to try and knock Ethan off the train as it emerges from the tunnel. He tells Ethan he's the only one who knows what the key unlocks, and when Ethan puts the knife to Gabriel's throat, we see the agent from earlier tell him to drop the knife. We see a countdown start to happen as Gabriel jumps off. And who the hell can hear when this train is going too fucking fast? That was my question. Like, these guys are yelling at each other, they're talking to each other, but fuck, man, this thing's going fast. You can't hear.
Yeah, and it also keeps speeding up because he killed the
operatives. The train crosses the bridge as Ethan hops down and tells Grace that no one can stop it. But Ethan says that they have the key as Gabriel brings the lighter out of his pocket and yells Ethan's name. Ethan. Yeah.
Oh, God, this is so bad.
The only thing that was missing was him yelling up at the sky and going, no.
Oh, my God.
Yep.
Like, it's that bad.
Ethan and Grace disconnect the cars as Ethan pulls Grace up. Bombs explode and the locomotive goes down to the rocks below.
The same bombs that we saw in Fast X. They're the same fucking bombs.
Meanwhile, Grace and Ethan, they have to jump train cars to survive. They get to the kitchen car and get in their most dangerous spot yet of avoiding fried grease as that car explodes. Anyone who's worked in these fucking restaurants knows that this grease is so fucking slippery. That was the part that made me think, oh God, they're fucked. They hop more cars as they fall to the water below until they're just hanging around. Ethan tells Grace to jump and grab his hand, which she does, but they're just hanging there until Paris, of all people, shows up and pulls them to safety before the train falls.
Ugh, okay, so we have officially entered Fast and Furious territory.
Oh my God, all these Fast and Furious references.
No, but it's the thing of old enemies there. Join the family.
But they've never done this, though, so...
No, yeah, they
which haven't. Makes it even worse. Now you pull this?
Well, she has respect because Ethan didn't kill her when he could have. So this made a better payoff than I've ever seen in any Fast and Furious film.
I agree it's paid off better, but it's what they've done. Every time that they have... I mean, fucking Jason Statham joins the family and he killed everybody.
Well,
that was the problem. He didn't kill Han, technically, as we find out.
Ugh, God. Fuck that series. Ethan gets Luther's speed wing, which is their ticket off the train. As Paris says, Gabriel was right. She did betray him. She then asks why he spared her life and then tells Ethan that the key unlocks the cesspool before wishing him good luck. So she had this information the entire time. Ethan thanks her and says that the wing can only carry one. So the agents show up as Ethan jumps. Kittredge approaches and they say that Paris still has a pulse. Grace tells Kittredge that Ethan says he's a man she can trust and she chooses to accept her choice. He then goes into a voiceover saying that we cannot escape the past. He says Ethan only bought Grace time. As the closer someone gets to you, the harder it is to keep them alive.
Now, if you really wanted to surprise people, you have Kittredge shoot her, and it's revealed he's the real entity. He's like chosen one.
Don't know if I would have gone with that.
I would have gone with it more than Gabriel.
We see Ethan land as a new day brings a new burden. and the key is only the beginning. Whatever it leads, whatever it takes to get there, he must do it on his own. Should he fail, Gabriel and the Entity will win. The world doesn't know it, but it is counting on him and his team as the camera moves underwater and we hear Kittredge say, "Good luck, Ethan," and credits roll on Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning.
Might as well have heard, "I have sent you, my only son."
No trailer after the credits? That was weird.
Thank God.
Because they hadn't done the second, they hadn't fucking reshot an entire second movie yet.
Adam, how'd you feel about how this ended?
Insulted. Honestly.
All right.
So I will give the movie credit. I didn't feel like I got ripped off. She has an arc and it's fulfilled, which is more than I can say for a lot of part ones.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not mad, but I can't lie to you and say that I immediately wanted to watch part two after this because I couldn't feel my legs.
All right. That's the end of Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning part one. Scale of 1 to 10. What do we give this movie? Adam, I have a feeling where you're going, but go ahead and unleash, sir.
So glad that we finally got the best Mission Impossible movie in this franchise, and I'm glad that it... Sorry, Entity's talking over me. Okay, so if you decide that you're going to write yourself your finale, which is clearly what this was, this movie decides for Tom Cruise, it is going to be a very self-serious, self-ejaculating type of thank you for everything you've done. And it does that at the expense of the last couple movies, which not only reinvigorated this franchise, but were some of the best spy movies that we've seen. And the three of us have seen a lot. Okay, Fallout, for its issues, was so much fun. It had a villain that was captivating. It had just kinetic energy that moved throughout. And Rogue Nation, before that, was what we all thought was the best of the franchise up till that point, with just new and creative and villainry and such. This seems like a major step backwards at a time that it's telling us that it's future thinking. The screenplay is crap. For the ideas that you had, it is not thought out. It feels like it was written in a weekend, then put into ChatGPT 1.0, not even a current version of it, to try and stretch this thing out and make it some semblance of a shootable script. And I don't even know if they had a shooting script on set, because the ADR that is obvious throughout this thing is an attempt to rewrite stories, rewrite characters, machinations, ideas. And at the end of this 2.5 hours, we still don't get those ideas thought out all the way. Your villain is Gabriel or the Entity, and we don't know who, what, why. We're told this guy has been around Ethan his entire life, that the reason Ethan's in the IMF is because of Gabriel. And yet by the end of this film, it doesn't break that out. So look, the additions to this film that you did with Hayley Atwell and Pom Clemente, they're a marvelous addition to this movie. I think that they do a good job of bringing some fun, some energy, and I like that. But this thing is so preoccupied with what it wants to be and what it wants to tell that it does a poor job of telling that idea, does a poor job of telling that story, and really does a poor job of being that frightening look at the future that Terminator is. This thing wants to be, and it fails at doing it. I enjoy watching the action scenes. I enjoy watching the acting. I enjoy the way this thing is shot, which is beautiful. The script, the words on page, are the downfall of this movie. It's insulting. That said, it's not the worst in this franchise. But it is way too long, it is way too self-serious, and this movie has the messiah complex that I think its star was guilty of having in the early 2000s. I'm going to give this a 5, and that is because I do like Hayley Atwell, I do like Pom Clemente, I do like when Rebecca Ferguson shows up, but this movie does not serve the people in this film. It is serving a master that we don't know exists. 5 on 10.
Wow. 5 from Mr. Bunch. Matt, what about you, sir?
So I think the thing that undoes this movie for me more than most is the fallout of the last two movies. It's a high bar to cross. And if this was, let's say, the fourth movie, maybe I wouldn't have to compare it to the previous ones, but this is the third go for this team, for this director, and with Cruise at the helm once again, you know, which is nothing new for this series. They're a Tom Cruise production for a reason. I don't think it was fair for me to go in expecting, I should say, I don't think it was unfair for me to go in with lofty expectations because there's precedent and it wasn't met. Now, that does not mean that I am going to lambast this film or give it a score that Adam would, because I can't say enough good things about the last 40 minutes. Like, once they set up the Orient Express, I think this thing wins me over in a big way. But I wish for the climactic installment that they had a much more developed script with a clear trajectory, which I still don't feel like they have leading into part two. I think the retooling of this and the revamp, it's obvious throughout, and it's a cliche, but this thing does feel like it was written by AI for a movie that's about the dangers of AI. And the thing that really hurts it the most for me is the leniency on the Jesus complex they're giving Ethan Hunt and specifically Tom Cruise. It's a hard thing for me to overcome because the last couple of movies, they've incorporated the team as best they could, but I felt like Ethan Hunt was still the lead, but not enough to make me feel like it's a, hog in the spotlight. I kind of feel like that's happened here, but the new addition of Haley Atwell does add a good dynamic. I just wish it didn't come at Ilsa's expense, which I do feel like it does to a certain degree. It's good, but I wanted greatness, which I got with the last two movies. So my score is going to reflect that, but I do like this more than several of the earlier installments before Macquarie got involved. So in the grand scheme of things, I'll give it a soft 7. I think if this had a script or something as tight as Rogue Nation, I'd go higher, but I can't go higher than a 7 with this script. I think it's flimsy at best.
Well, I have a lot of the same feelings as Adam, but I'm going to turn my gear shift down a notch because while I feel the same as him, I don't feel as strongly as him about it. I think this movie is a fun watch in a lot of ways. I also think, again, as I mentioned, I feel the concept of this villain, the conceit of AI and everything that comes with it, which is all we've been talking about for about the last 5 years or so, is a stroke of genius when it comes to adversaries that Ethan or anybody just would not be able to figure out. How do you beat that in a field and in a world where we are so dependent on technology? How do you defeat something such as a artificial entity? But given that, the execution of this and the addition of Gabriel and everything we have mentioned as bad plot points, I will agree with both of you on this. I think the writing in this is shit. I think they had 5 years of retooling as they were shooting this thing, and it really bogged down the end result. But I had fun watching this. I had fun watching the chemistry between Atwell and Cruise. I had fun watching the train at the end. I had fun watching the chase. All of this stuff just goes through me as I'm watching this film. But to make this about a goddamn key that we have no clue about until the final few minutes of this movie just grinds this to a halt. I just feel like I'm swimming through mud as I'm watching this. Can we please get to something that is worthwhile? Because these negotiations for this fucking key and everything surrounding it, as well as did she pickpocket it? Did she not? Is it the real one? Is it not? Fucking A, just get on with it. 2 hours and 40 minutes of this. This could have been trimmed down easily to 215, and I would have given it a higher score. Still, I have the same score as Matt written down because I had a good time watching this film. This is a soft 7, just as Matt has. I find it to be a good watch, but at the same time, after it was over, I was not craving the final one. I felt this should have been the final one. And we'll talk about next week's film, but you really could have made this the final one and combined those two. But we'll get to that next week. As it is, soft 7, decent time, but I have rewatched Rogue Nation a good number of times. I've rewatched Fallout just a few times. I don't know when I'll rewatch this one. I did it for this podcast. I did it twice for this podcast, and I think I'm good for a while. So 7 out of 10 for Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 for me. All right, boys, we have one left. 2 months of talking Tom Cruise and the IMF will come to a grinding halt, at least for now, when we talk Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning. Adam, what are you expecting next week when we get to our final podcast about Mission Impossible?
It's a mission that we have chose to accept. It's hard to believe that there's 8 of these. Like, I feel like we just started, but I'm excited to see it. My buddy and me, like, we started these when we were in high school, man. And it's crazy to think that 30 years later, this same person is still making this movie. And regardless how we feel about that, I admire the hell out of that. Yeah, we've had Bond movies for 50 years, but we've had so many different Bonds. Imagine one that went 30 years in the role. So I appreciate and admire what this franchise is. I also think we're going to discuss why the movie was delayed and why titles change and what that could mean going forward. And if somebody making it clear to the audience that by putting the title the way that it is, that you think you're going to kill someone off, is that manipulation? Is it trying to spike, you know, your box office, and did it work, and is it true? It's going to be interesting to discuss that. And do you fittingly end 30 years of a spy franchise that started off as a TV series? And which is better? Which is going to be remembered more? Oh, I can't wait to see what we deal with the final reckoning.
All right, Matt, you have predicted that this will probably be the longest podcast that we've done on this series is next week's. You obviously have a lot to say about it. What are you expecting when we get to next week's film?
I want to know if final is going to be a definitive, like they pressed the nuclear option of killing off Ethan Hunt, like they killed off Craig's Bond, if it's that level of finality, or if it's final dot 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 for now, or the final reckoning to be determined, because they could go either way and neither would surprise me. But I'm curious to know how they're going to wrap this up, because they got plenty to improve on, but we've also seen part twos that are steadily worse than the first part, and sometimes some questions are better left unanswered.
Well, that's next week, as well as we will reveal what our next franchise will be. Matt's teased it, and it is something I cannot wait for the three of us to discuss. That's going to be quite the action franchise. My God, this seems like the year of action franchises, Matt. You have Lethal Weapon, you have this, and we're going to have the franchise we'll be talking about in a couple weeks. So, did you do that on purpose, sir?
Well, it's based on some of the new releases gave me justification, and Lethal Weapon tied into Christmas. So I had to come up with Mission Possibles to get these franchises finally reviewed.
Let me tell you, next week's movie, Jen had absolutely zero interest in. The next franchise, that movie, she is aching for us to go. So she can't wait for it. That's just a little bit of a preview to what that'll be. But we'll talk about that next week. But until next week, when we get to Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning. This podcast will self-destruct in 5 seconds. Thank you, boys.
Where's the disc?
Where is the disc?
You're looking at it. I am the disc. I memorized it. All 2.4 billion in numbered accounts. If that vest goes off, you get nothing. Without this money, you're nothing. Without me, you're nothing.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Go!
It's Benji. Where am I going?
They're coming!
We're not ready.
Then get ready.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
You can understand you're very upset. Kittredge, you've never seen me very upset.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Your line's not long enough!
No shit!
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
So let me get this straight. When there's a mission none of you can handle, you just leave word for a nameless man and hope he gets the job done. Is that it?
Should he choose to accept?
Please visit and check out our Percolated Media Facebook page to get an advanced look at what the boys will be reviewing that week, as well as other things such as Matt and Garrett's wrestling podcast, what the site has in store for the future, some periodically done written reviews, and so much more.
I am waiting.
Message us, give us your thoughts, visit and share. We greatly appreciate interacting with you, our listeners.
I got exactly what you asked for. Did you want something else?
Check out the Percolated Media Archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including The Incredibles movies, The Planet of the Apes franchise,
The Lethal Weapon series, The Movies of the Alien franchise,
The Mad Max movies, Avatar, Pirates of the Caribbean, Indiana Jones, the film adaptations of author Stephen King, Jurassic Park,
the ongoing Marvel series,
and so many more.
Well, this is not mission difficult, Mr. Hunt. It's mission impossible.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
He made it! He made it!
I knew he'd make it.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
You want to shake hands with the devil, that's fine with me. I just want to make sure that you do it in hell.
Scheduling by Matt.
Read this. Slowly.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
Listen. Talk to me. We can talk. Like gentlemen.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men and a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
Reggie, did you recover anything?
Yes. Despite the aforementioned conditions of the hard drive you brought back, I managed to recover portions of 24 email files. Also made what I believe to be a thoroughly promotion-worthy breakthrough.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
You wanted me to listen. This is me listening.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
That was not easy, but I did it.
Would not let it not be made at this point.
And also, what I wanted from this was, I wanted something similar to No Time to Die, which I still really like. I liked it at the time. I was happy to get a proper good send-off for Daniel Craig as Bond. And I would say for Bond in general, because I have no confidence in Amazon taking it over, which could be a podcast in and of itself. I might do that as a solo show, to be honest, once we get a casting announcement. And we learn more about what it's going to be, but I felt like...
I was really checking my watch when I saw this in theaters the first time, and these things could have easily been cut.
Well, dear Chat GP entity, modern... turn this down. Wait,
Adam, go first. Go ahead.
Sorry, dear Chat.
That would have been too much of a stretch, this series.
Yep.
I tell you, we're only one film away from him going to space, but...
Well, Ludacris already beat him there.
Ethan says that...
I thought this franchise was going to conclude with them opening up. You know how the Kingsmen have a tailor shop? They open up a magic shop.
Magic
as their cover to the outside world.
Like Buffy season 4. when Giles opens the magic shop.
Yeah, let's do no season one puppet show,
though. Yeah.
Because as much as I love the trope of evil dummies, that's a terrible episode.
But they made it so that the dummy was actually working for the good. That was so funny. Got it.
Yeah. I mean, they got it right with that last season of Angel with the
yeah. Oh, puppets. God, that episode's so fucking funny. Jen was laughing her ass off at that.
Oh, it's one of the best episodes of both shows for that matter.
Just for the Angel Spike fight.
I wish the entity controlled Gabriel like a ventriloquist dummy, where it literally like manifests a hand and shoves it up his ass. Like that's basically what this is.
Adam, I encourage you to YouTube Angel Spike puppet fight. I guarantee you'll laugh your ass.
You've been encouraging me to watch Buffy though for what, 30 years now.
This is a 2 minute clip. And
it's not Buffy, it's Angel.
Yeah, it's Angel.
If you want me to pull the comp book guide, well, actually, Carl.
I'll get on that with Smallville.
Yeah. So Grace fights